This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. At the beginning of this century, when tech stocks were all the rage and startups were appearing everywhere, Yale professor and renowned economist Robert Shiller was already warning of a bubble, and he was right. Years later, when housing prices were skyrocketing and millions of Americans were betting big on real estate as a long-term investment, Robert Shiller again predicted an impending crisis. Sadly, as time would tell, he was two for two. Now, with home prices rising and the economy improving, many people are getting the sense that we're finally out of the woods after the recession. And with this feeling returns the idea that buying a home today means financial gains down the road.
Today, home sales are up nearly 50% from where they were in the worst of the crisis. Home building has more than doubled. New foreclosures are at their lowest level since 2006. Since 2012, nearly 10 million fewer Americans had their homes underwater. Rising home prices have put hundreds of billions of dollars of wealth back in the pockets of middle-class families. Our job's not done, but what we're doing is working, and we've got to keep at it.
That's President Obama speaking in Arizona on January 8th of this year. But is it really time to celebrate? Should we be rethinking this conventional wisdom that home prices will continue again in an upward trend? In the latest edition of his book, Irrational Exuberance, Shiller suggests maybe we should just put a pause button on here. We'll be speaking with him on what exactly modern-day home owners should be doing right now. And also, we'll talk about what we've learned about investor behavior over the course of the last 15 years since the first edition of his book. Robert Shiller is a Nobel Prize-winning economist and Sterling Professor of Economics at Yale University. His brand new book is Irrational Exuberance, the Revised and Expanded Third Edition. Robert Shiller, welcome back to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Your book, of course, titled Irrational Exuberance. It's a term long associated with Alan Greenspan, but something that was based on the work that you did many years ago. Maybe you can explain for our listeners what exactly that term means.
Actually, the term goes back 100 years. I traced it back. It's a Wall Street term, but I think Alan Greenspan made it famous. In 1996, he gave a talk in which he uttered those words. This is a dinner talk in Washington, D.C. And immediately the Japanese stock market was open. The market crashed in Japan. Just seemed like minutes after he said that. How did that happen? Well, apparently Japanese were listening to his talk, and it gave them a scare to hear that mentioned. This then became a symbol for the craziness of markets. In fact, it was worse than just Japan. It spread across the whole world, even back to New York. Just because Alan Greenspan said in a speech, irrational exuberance, it caused a mini crash around the world. It just goes to show, people thought, how crazy these markets really are.
But Alan Greenspan, of course, isn't the only person watching this at the time. Hundreds of thousands of other very smart people were. Are we all such sheep, Robert Shiller, that indeed the utterance of one term from the very powerful, of course, Fed board chief, could send the markets changing so much? I mean, are we really such creatures that respond to words in that way?
Well, I think that you're right. We're not sheep, and people are smarter than it seems from this story. But the reason why the market responds, I think it goes back to what John Maynard Keynes, in his 1936 book called Beauty Contest, that when we're looking at stocks, we're trying to pick stocks, we're not necessarily focusing on what is important and makes sense. We're focusing on what the next investor is likely to focus on. Right. And so you hear Alan Greenspan make this statement, and then you think, hey, maybe people will react to this statement, so I better react first. That's what happened. That's a beauty contest story. We're not trying to judge the real value of stocks. We're trying to predict what they're going to do in the next few days. And if that's our attitude and we're looking at each other, it brings in a sort of craziness to the market, even if individually the people think that they're being very rational.
So beyond the impact of this story and these words, flesh out a little bit more for us, if you would, what you see as the meaning of irrational exuberance is, Robert Shiller, and maybe how that has changed over the course of the last 15 years since the first edition of your book came out.
Well, I like the term irrational exuberance because it replaces earlier terms like speculative orgy. Well, I don't think orgy is the right word to describe what happens during a stock market boom. It's not lust. It's not craziness in that sense. It's people thinking, hey, I'm going to outsmart the next guy. This is a game. I can play this game to win. And that means I'm going to try to psych everybody else out and move first. And that kind of game results in a sort of mass craziness, even though the people there are not really crazy. They're exuberant, maybe. That's all.
As we talk about what might cause investors to en masse become exuberant, give us some examples. I mean, what's something that you feel that Wall Street has largely overvalued because of this type of exuberance, that indeed, as we do a postmortem, we maybe look back, we can say, well, it's not all it was cracked up to be, or people really were out on a limb there speculating on something that really didn't have the fundamentals to back it up?
Usually the stories that drive markets have some validity. Notably, I think the biggest market movement we've seen in recent memory was the upswing in stock prices from 1982 to 2000. And they peaked in January of 2000 by the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and then had a big correction. What was driving that? Well, I say in my book that there were many things driving it. I gave a list of 12 precipitating factors. But one of them was the Internet. The Internet was just coming in. It first became available to the public in 1994. And it was indeed a profoundly important story. But the problem is it got exaggerated. The market went beyond what was rational. And let me just add, isn't it a funny coincidence that the market peaked in January of 2000? That's right after the millennium celebration. So I think this sounds totally crazy, but I think it's a fact that all the futuristic talk in the late 1990s about the new millennium got people a little bit out of sync with reality. Well, the market peaked as soon as we finished our hangover from the new millennium celebration.
Well, it also, of course, peaked after all of the dire warnings that the entire world was going to shut down on January 1st, 2000, when all the clocks changed over.
Right.
Of course, we were all terribly concerned the world would end. When the world didn't end, let's pop the champagne, right?
Yeah, I remember that. The Y2K problem.
Yeah, it seems like such a long time ago now. We're talking with Robert Shiller. He's the Nobel Prize winner, whose book is Irrational Exuberance, first came out in 2000, and this is the third edition now, revised and expanded. And we're talking with him about the ideas behind irrational exuberance and how the markets work. We're going to be talking about home prices in just a little bit. So talk a bit about the bubble that was created in advance of the most recent housing collapse of 2007-2008. What you saw at the time, and how it's all played out now. I mean, what about what you predicted before the housing bubble burst, Robert Shiller, came to pass, and what things maybe didn't you get right?
Yeah, all these bubbles are usually mysterious. They seem to appear at the wrong time. Why now? And then they reach epidemic proportions. Now, I think that in reality, they are a sort of epidemic, like a disease epidemic. They're spread by emotional contagion rather than viral contagion, and it's by the contagion of ideas. So the housing market showed its biggest upswing in the United States ever from 1997 to 2006. There's no objective reason for that. If you look at construction costs or population or interest rates, I mean, there's nothing to justify that except talk. And something came up then. I listed factors that might have contributed to it. But again, they're always a mystery why these things happen when they do.
How much of it, though, was created? I mean, what we've seen afterward is the creation of all of these various investment devices, the availability of free money, essentially, to buy a house. A lot of it was talk, but an awful lot of it seemed to be fueled by banks that were trying to get me exuberant about the idea of buying a house. I mean, it's one thing to think that it's a good investment, Robert Shull, but it's another thing when somebody's handing me, essentially, hundreds of thousands of free dollars to invest in. It seems as though there's something more than just investor behavior and thought processes behind it. There is something really engineered about this crisis.
Correct. The marketing people are always trying to engineer demand. That's their job, isn't it? They're professional. And they've been doing it now. Professional marketing has been developing for over 100 years. Now, the problem is that they don't always find success with their ad campaigns. Sometimes the mood is ripe, though, for a change. And it's a very complicated story about what was driving this. It was partly, I think, an echo reaction to the stock market boom. The boom of the 1990s got people interested in investing like they hadn't been ever before, but then they were disappointed by the stock market, and so their attention switched to the housing market. People had their sense of personal identity in as investors, and they just naturally migrated from the stock market to the housing market. But it's not just individuals, it was institutions. It was the presidential campaign of 2004 when George W. Bush announced the ownership society, and people concluded that the U.S. government, you just played Obama, but you could have played George Bush, triumphant about the increase in home ownership rates and home prices, as if that was a great achievement. So people thought the government was behind it. And then we had even private institutions that got a little bit out of sync, like the rating agencies that were rating mortgage securities were giving them excessively high ratings, so that investors were willing to loan on these so-called liar's loans or loans that hadn't been adequately vetted. So that you had mortgage markets that were exceptionally loose at the same time. We had monetary policy that was loose. So it was a confluence of many factors that produced the biggest housing bubble in U.S. history to reach its peak in 2006.
When you talk about marketing, though, just even the role of these last two presidents and many presidents before, they seem to be selling something that is very specific. We call it the American dream of owning your own home. Do you think that our politics are irresponsible by saying essentially that the ownership of a home is one of the great achievements in life, and that all of our systems should be pointing toward people investing in this way so that they're either building a new home or buying a home off the market? Do you think that there's something inherently wrong with that vision of the American dream?
Yes, I think there is something wrong with that. And politicians, I think we have to be thankful in America that our politicians have the extent of integrity that they do. But it is a rough and tumble battle to get elected. And they don't always stay really true to the truth. It's just a fact of life. But the American dream, that's a term coined by James Truslow Adams in a book he wrote in the 1930s. He said it was the homeowner owning a home. Actually, I would say the American dream is farm ownership. We had kind of that goes back hundreds of years. Isn't it wonderful having your own farm? You have an orchard and you have a brook and you have beautiful places, all your own. That was the American dream. And then it became impossible in the 20th century because we just didn't have enough, there weren't enough need for farmers anymore. So it became a new story I think there is something nice about homeowner. I own a home, but I think it got overrated, and the idea that home prices will always go up got entrenched into our thinking as a mistake.
And do you see that persisting now as we see home prices again rising up, and we listen to President Obama saying now's the time to be able to get into a home, and we see these incredibly, incredibly low interest rates that allow people to once again get into home ownership for the first time? Do you see it happening once again, Robert Shull, where people are going to be led down the same path, and 5, 10, 7 years down the road, we have another bubble around home prices?
Well, home prices have gone up quite a bit, over 30%. according to our S&P Case-Shiller indexes in the United States, and in some places over 60%. So from the bottom in 2012. So it's been quite a upsurge that we've seen already. Home prices are no longer cheap. They're getting up there, but they're still not as high as they were in 2006. And I think it's not an unambiguously good thing that they're going up. Don't we want affordable housing, that everyone can afford a house? Why is it good that home prices go up? I don't think it is good, and I don't think it should be an object of national policy.
And I guess that was my worry. If indeed it's not a good thing, are we heading down the same path where not just are home prices going to go up so that people at the low end can't afford them, but also that we're going to be tricked into this idea that our home is a piggy bank, that it's a way for us to build this equity that we can cash in once again, that we're essentially going to do the same thing? Do you see that happening again?
I think it is somewhat happening again, although not as dramatic. The home price boom in the 2000s was driven substantially by an idea that housing is a wonderful investment. The story would go, well, the population is growing, the economy is growing, but we only have so much land, and we're running out of land. So doesn't that mean home prices will always go up? Turns out that hasn't been a very good argument. From 1890 to 1990, as I calculated, if you correct for inflation, home prices virtually didn't go up at all. It was zero. You know, compare that with the stock market. It was just not a good investment. Why is that? Well, I'll tell you, most of the value of homes in most of the United States is the structure, not the land. And structures are expensive. They wear out. You have to keep maintaining them. And they go out of style. People want the new home, not the old home. Although sometimes they want the old home, but usually they want something new and better. So why would you think it's a good investment just to hold the house, let it keep it maintained against weather and damage? It just doesn't make any sense. I would compare it with, did you ever think of buying cars as an investment? So you could do this. You could buy a brand new car, have the tank drained and it mothballed, and you put it in a garage and leave it for 10 years. Would that be a good idea? No, it's not a good idea, because 10 years from now, they'll want something different. Why would you want to do that? Well, that's sort of the mentality that a lot of people have with homes. They think it's just going to go up in value. And that's just not historically correct.
It is really funny. As I get ready to take a break here, the whole idea that my 120-year-old New England house getting beat up by the weather for all these years, somehow I should think that it would be worth more tomorrow than it is today. It is a rather remarkable thought, but that's how Americans have lived for a long time. This is why we need Robert Shiller here to tell us more about it. His book is Irrational Exuberance, the revised and expanded third edition. We're going to be talking more with a Nobel Prize winner in just a few moments. What do you think the state of our economy is right now? What are you doing with your home? Are you bought in on the idea that home prices will continue to rise? Your questions for Robert Shiller coming up after this break, where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, our guest is Robert Shiller. He is the Yale economist, a Nobel Prize winner, whose book Irrational Exuberance has caused a stir over the course of the last 15 years, talking about market inefficiencies and investor behavior. It's now in its revised and expanded third edition as we come out of one recession. Who knows where we're headed next? Let's first go to Stephen in Wyndham. Hi there, Stephen. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks, John. Hey, Dr. Schiller, fan club here. I really think that you called it, and it's for your average investor. It's so hard to figure this stuff out. Well, I want to talk about China specifically, but I want to throw a couple ideas in there. Monetary policy, I mean, we're about to go raise the interest rates. Europe, QE1, I guess they're calling it. And then I'm really worried that China, what do they call it, devaluation or deflagish, I can't remember what the term is when the prices fall. And they're having a rational exuberance with their housing market. I'm worried China's in for problems.
Well, a few things in there, Stephen, and thank you so much. I guess maybe you want to tackle China first, his question about China, Robert Shiller?
Well, China is going through a lot of the same things that we've seen in the U.S. Sometimes they're more volatile than the U.S., maybe because they're less experienced with market speculation. They've had huge swings in their stock market that dwarf ours. They've also had housing market boom, and they're going now in China through the same issues with so-called shadow banking that we see in the U.S., that is, banks that are making more and more loans outside of the usual parameters. And this has now started to reach concern of Chinese authorities. So, yeah, they've made big mistakes in investing in China. That is, people have bought homes in large developments that turn out to be vacant. So China is a complicated problem because they don't have the same investment opportunities. They can't invest freely around the world. They may mistrust financial investments. They want to have an investment that they can see. And moreover, with the shortage of women, you know, the one-child policy, many parents in China will buy a home for their son as an idea to help him to find a wife. So there's a huge demand for housing, and it's probably exaggerated in China. And it may cause problems in the future.
When it comes to Stephen's other question, I wanted to ask you, of course, the Federal Reserve Board meeting today expected to signal that interest rates will soon rise. What's the impact of that, of a statement like that, that's essentially not saying interest rates are rising now, but that interest rates will eventually rise after this long, long time in which they have not?
Yes, we've had very low interest rates ever since the financial crisis of 2008. It's been a long time. People can't remember when they used to be higher. The federal funds rate has been down in the range from 0 to 0.25 percentage points. And longer-term interest rates have been really low, including the home mortgage rate. In 2012, they hit a record low of 3.35% for 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. You could, as an individual, you could borrow for 30 years at that rate. So there are issues about that. This is really a critical turning point. How much longer are these low interest rates going to continue? There's a worry among many observers that there will be a major correction in the bond market, meaning long-term interest rates will go up. And if that happens, mortgage rates will go up. It makes it harder to buy a house. Home prices might go down. I'm not trying to be alarmist here. I'm talking about the general fear that I see expressed. And the stock market might go down. So the critical turning point, I discussed this in my new third edition of my book, Irrational Exuberance. The problem is how is the economy going to respond after we leave a period of extremely low interest, really record low interest rates? And we don't know yet.
Do you share some of these worries? I mean, do you have a crystal ball, if it would, on this one? I mean, and see where we may be going in the next few years as we come out of these very, very low interest rates that have, as you say, really reset everything for our ideas of what it's like to borrow money?
Well, I don't think anyone has a crystal ball because there really isn't any exact precedent for the economic situation that we're in now. When have interest rates been so low? Well, they got very low in the Great Depression of the 1930s. But what ended up happening after that event was instead of a Fed tightening, we got World War II, which was highly stimulative for the economy, and it ended the Great Depression. I sometimes worry that that's happening right now with the terrorist activities in the Middle East and now with Russia invading Ukraine. These might be symptoms of a weak world economy. And so let's hope that it doesn't develop along that way. The more benign outcome would be just governments raising interest rates around the world. And we really don't have experience with that. So how does anybody know for sure what will happen?
Hmm. I want to go to Nate, who's calling from Glastonbury. Hi, Nate. Go ahead. You're on with Robert Shiller.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I had a quick question. Just a note, I kind of hear Bastiat's broken window fallacy. I'm not quite as agreeable that building things to blow them up is a way to economic prosperity. But I'd like to hear your thoughts on the belief that really the Federal Reserve, fiat currency, artificial manipulation of interest rates on top of government intervention in the free market in the form of GSEs and regulations which drive up prices and distort the market are really ultimately the cause of all asset bubbles.
Thanks, Nate.
Yeah. Well, that's a complicated question. I take it as really a question about free markets and whether there should be regulation. This has been a major dispute among Americans for, from time immemorial, actually. But particularly, when I'm thinking of Milton Friedman and other people from Chicago in the half a century ago were saying that regulations are generally harmful. George Stigler at Chicago said, regulations are mostly captured by the regulated. He thought that they're used to sustain monopoly power and that actually companies like to be regulated because they can bribe the regulators and make it turn to their advantage. So this is a very interesting and long dispute about the role of regulation and of agencies like the GSEs or the Federal Reserve in our economy. And I don't know how we can resolve it quickly here. My own view is that there's a little bit of truth on both sides. We can over-regulate, and free markets are important. They're really what everyone's been learning all over the world, that you need free markets. On the other hand, completely unregulated free markets are a problem too. So we have to find a happy medium. That's my opinion.
And we're going to be hearing a little bit more from another economist about regulating markets in a little bit. I want to take a few more questions. People are raising some things I want to raise here. Ken is calling from Hartford. Hi there, Ken.
Hi, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Schilling. I just had a quick question. One of the industries that seems to experience a somewhat regular boom and bust is the oil industry. And I wanted to pick your brain and see what your thoughts were on the recent sort of shale buildup and now this bust that's been experiencing by the American oil industry.
It's a great question, Ken. It leads into a few other things that I want to ask about our energy economy, Robert Shiller. But what do you think about Ken's question?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it's an interesting question from the standpoint of an investor because commodities are an important asset class. Historically, investing in commodities has provided good returns. I'm talking over the last half century. Yet most people don't directly invest in them. Most people have their investments in bonds or stocks or their houses. So I think it's an interesting diversification move. And it's an interesting thought that this might be a good time to go into commodities, especially, let's say, oil, because oil has such historically low prices. So if you believe in mean reversion, that if they're so low, they'll probably go up, then you might want to invest in oil. The problem is, however, that the oil futures markets already build into them expectations of increases in oil. So you wouldn't be the first person to predict that. They probably will go up, but it's not so easy to make money from just betting that they'll go up. I think it's a very complicated issue to try to predict what is a good investment right now. But my thought is that, as a general rule, diversification across all major asset classes is good investing policy. And so, as a general rule, investing in oil, among other things, is part of sensible investing.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about our energy economy. You mentioned that it's not the first time, clearly, that we may be headed into a world in which our global economy is then tied to conflicts around the world. And hopefully those two things aren't exacerbating one another in too terrible a way, but it certainly seems as though there are signs in that direction. The other thing, though, that we have added in, maybe, Robert Shiller, that we've never had before is the looming impact of climate change. So on one hand, you have this seeming need of the world to get away from the fossil fuel economy that we've had. And then we, of course, have the volatility that comes with the real instability in places like the Middle East and even some of the instability of the boom and bust cycle of shale right here in the United States. I guess I'm wondering how you see climate change playing into the other instabilities that we see around the commodity of oil and how that's going to really impact our economy in the years to come.
Yeah, well, climate change is one of the biggest problems. I'm glad you brought it up because it's potentially disastrous for many people. If the question is not just what do we expect climate change to do, it's what is the outlying worst case? Remember, we have only one planet to live on. And, you know, there are a lot of climate change deniers who may sometimes make valid points. But the real question is, how sure are we that it's okay to let the climate just go its way? We've had regular United Nations-sponsored conferences on climate change, and nations of the world come together and try to decide policy on climate change policy. The problem is that we haven't done anything. We haven't done much to solve the problem.
But I guess I'm wondering, though, could in some way could markets lead the way on this? If we look at a worst case scenario that is our planet essentially dying at our own hands, might markets take a look at this and say, look, we need to invest and we see an upside in investing in technologies and behaviors that reverse those trends or at least mitigate those trends? I mean, do you see that as a place where if nations can't get together at some big summit and solve the problem of climate change, then indeed individual investors and markets can help to solve the problem by saying, look, we got to do something because we're going to really face a crisis here and we need to invest in the right place.
Well, the idea that has been around at least since the Kyoto Protocol in 1997 is that governments need to do one major thing is to create a market for climate change. So in a sense, a market for pollution so that there's a price to polluting the air that would create an incentive for companies to devise new technologies that would be less polluting or to economize on pollution. That has been an idea, but it has never taken shape. The fundamental problem remains that I'm talking like an economist now, that pollution is an externality. If I dump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it doesn't affect my own amount. It doesn't affect me. It's just going to be spread over the whole world, but it affects everybody else. So we have to somehow create a system that internalizes the externality so that people who dump into the air pollutants are penalized one way or another. And I think it involves both governments and markets. What the idea has been around now for over 20 years that what we need is market-based solutions to this problem, but we are not getting there yet.
But that's a market-based solution on the side of mitigating the problem at the smokestack level. But I'm talking also about the generation piece of it. I mean, the desire to invest in technologies proactively so that we actually get to a cleaner planet. We get to a place where we're driving more fuel-efficient cars or we're living right in cities more than we're living in suburbs, et cetera, et cetera. Is there some sort of a market-based solution on that end, do you think?
Yeah, this gets into an idea about how much individuals can do without government support. There's a new book out by Wagner and Weitzman about the climate that just came out a month or so ago that gives us an example of what can be done. The city of Copenhagen, Denmark, and they call theirs the Copenhagen theory of climate change. The idea is, what happened in Copenhagen is people decided to start riding bicycles to work, and it became a thing in Copenhagen. So the city of government put in lots of good bicycle paths. They're really the bicycle capital of the world now. And this representative form of idealism. Another example is green investing. Some people will not invest in companies that don't show evidence that they've done specific things to improve the environment. Now, you can be very skeptical about the impact of any of these things. So they're riding bicycles in Copenhagen, and some people are not investing in polluting companies. But you could say it's not solving the problem. Well, I think that the Wagner and Weitzman book, though, says, yes, it doesn't solve the problem, but it paves the way. It changes the atmosphere and allows us better to eventually solve the problem. So I don't minimize these things. When people show idealism in their investments or their actions, even though they're not coming close to solving the problem by their individual actions.
Hmm. One more quick phone call before our break. Rich is in Trumbull. Hello there, Rich. Go ahead. You're on with Robert Shiller.
Yes. Mr. Shiller, could you speak something to the bond market? Like, it seems like no one is buying our bonds, the foreign governments, and the Fed is just digitizing all the money, and they're buying the bonds. Seems like a closed-loop takeover. I don't know. Can you speak to that, please?
Yes. I think the closed loop refers specifically to quantitative easing, which was a policy. We had three separate quantitative easing, QE1, QE2, and QE3, but they ended last year. So the United States government, specifically the Federal Reserve, is no longer buying bonds, although it's holding the ones that it did buy. On the other hand, quantitative easing continues in other places. In Europe, the European Central Bank has just launched on a program of quantitative easing. So this is a sort of closed loop. Yeah, the treasuries of governments issue bonds, and who knows who buys them? It's the central bank of the essentially part of the same government. This has been used to stimulate the world economy, and it has worked. The U.S. has had record low interest rates, both at short and long term, and that's boosted the housing market, it's boosted investment, and it's made us one of the strongest economies in the advanced world. But it's not natural or normal, and it's something that can't continue forever. And that's what we have to look at now. How will we exit from this aggressive stimulus policy? I think that it will be all right, that a gradual exit from this policy. We've already stopped quantitative easing, and that hasn't caused any disaster yet. I'm hopeful that Janet Yellen in the United States and Mario Draghi in Europe will manage this whole policy so that we come out all right. But there are uncertainties about it. We don't know how we're going to exit from how smooth the exit will be.
We're pleased to be talking with Robert Shiller. He's the Nobel Prize-winning economist whose book is Irrational Exuberance. It's in its revised and expanded third edition right now. We're talking with him about some of the big ideas in that book and also a lot about the economy. When we come back, we're going to talk with someone who's written about regulating irrational exuberance. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, we'll revisit our program in which, for a year, journalist Karen Brown set out to learn why more young doctors aren't choosing primary care. Her findings are the subject of a documentary called The Path to Primary Care, Who Will Be the Next Generation of Frontline Doctors? Karen joined us along with primary care professionals to weigh in on some of the latest trends and to tell us what the future of primary care looks like here in the Northeast and across America. Hope you can join us on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, we're talking with someone who knows a lot about people feeling good about themselves. Irrational Exuberance is the name of his book. He's Robert Shiller. He's a Nobel Prize-winning economist at Yale University, and he joins us from our New Haven studios today. I want to welcome in Peter Hwang, who's professor and DeMuth Chair of Business Law at the University of Colorado. He specializes in law and psychology, securities regulation. He's authoring an upcoming book based on his article, Tiger Cub Strikes Back, about strategies for better thinking and decision-making. And Peter, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
You've written about regulating irrational exuberance. Give us a thumbnail sketch of how you might propose to do that.
Yes. So I think instead of regulating markets and instead of regulating securities issuers or people who market selling homes, maybe a better idea is to help people think better, help people make better decisions, help people choose wiser. Right. So the idea is that oftentimes when people make choices, they're influenced by emotional factors and other things so that they later regret the choice they made because in their decision-making process, they weren't as thoughtful or as mindful as they could have been. So an example would be sort of the 10-10-10 heuristic. Whenever you're thinking about making a decision, think about how you will feel in 10 minutes, in 10 months, and in 10 years. A lot of the times, the things you're motivated by in terms of making decisions are short-term emotional influences. 10 minutes from now, how will I feel? 10 months from now. And when you think about the 10-10-10 rule, you realize in 10 months, or in 10 years, things may not matter, but in 10 minutes, you get this emotional payoff. So when it comes to like buying a home or investing in securities markets, people are often thinking about short-term gains and making quick profits. And if they think about long-term investment and about long-term payoffs, then they might make a wiser choice. So the idea is to help people think of systematic ways or rules to guide them to making decisions that they themselves want. Right? So as kids, we're all taught to put on our thinking caps. So one idea is to say, why did you ever take off your thinking cap? Or you should definitely have your thinking cap on when you're thinking about buying a home or buying stocks. You should think about this decision sort of carefully, thoughtfully. Another well-known sort of action people say often is sleep on it. But it's not just the sleeping. It's the sleeping gives you different perspectives. It's the fact that sleeping lets you get distance from what you're thinking about.
But a
better decision.
I guess, are adult investors, though, Peter, really any different than those children from the studies who are given the opportunity to either, you know, take a marshmallow now or wait for two marshmallows later? At the end, it seems as though at our core, we're not very good at making that really great decision because we are such short-term actors. How do we change people's behavior?
Exactly. You're absolutely right. So Walter Mischel's marshmallow experiments show that not all kids, but some kids have an easier time, other kids have a harder time sort of exhibiting self-control. So one question is whether self-control is a muscle that you deplete with use or that you get stronger with exercise. And there's evidence sort of on both sides. It's also related to how much glucose you have. So if you're hungry, you should not be making serious decisions. But one idea is instead of sort of exerting willpower and resisting temptation, which is difficult, the better thing might be not to put yourself in a situation where you have to be tempted. So instead of buying cookies and then say, I have to resist these cookies or donuts, don't buy them in the first place, or buy smaller packages, or do something so that instead of mind over matter, it's matter over mind. Change the environment or situation so that you don't have to be tempted or have to resist, which is hard and difficult. And there's also this idea of cognitive depletion. The more decisions you make, the worse you are at making them and the more tired you get. And so don't spend time or effort on decisions that aren't really important. Save your resources, mental and emotional, for those really important decisions.
Well, it's interesting. And Robert Shiller, I was going to ask you about some of the things that have changed since you first wrote Irrational Exuberance. One of the things that seems has changed in our society is what Peter talks about as cognitive depletion. We just have more things to worry about, more things on our minds and in front of our screens. I'm wondering if there's something to that, Robert Shiller, about the changes in our behavior over these last 15 years. And I'd also like to comment briefly on whether or not you think some of Peter's ideas can work.
I think some of his ideas are great. Yeah, this is behavioral economics, which I'm also a big fan of. And regulators have to think not just about the lies that might be disseminated by advertisers. They have to think about distortions. For example, I know Peter Hwang in one of his articles talks about day traders, that there are ads you'll see on TV for day trading services that will help you buy and sell stocks quickly from time to time. But what these people don't point out is that studies of day traders show that very few of them are successful. Most of them end up just losing a lot of money and then dropping out. They don't publicize that. they show skits showing brilliantly success or suggesting brilliant success. That's manipulative, and I think regulators have to maybe take a look at that. Now, as far as cognitive depletion, we're talking about, yeah, we live in an internet world now where we are, there's so many facts and information that we can look at that I think potentially have psychological effects on us. We can immerse ourselves now. You know, it used to be you had to watch whatever was on TV. Now, if you so choose, you can watch an investment station all day, and you can have three internet screens simultaneously showing you different things. I think that it might bring a greater risk of insanity, investor insanity. It might make for bubbles, and bubbles are, it's ever since the internet, they have been more dramatic than they were before.
But Peter, I have to ask you, though, in the few minutes that we have left, there's the flip side to this, too. We don't want our investment strategies to be driven by this irrational exuberance all the time and be making bad decisions. But the flip side of that, Peter, isn't it anxiety? It's that we won't want to take a risk on something important, that we'll miss the boat or the next big opportunity. How do we guard against that while continuing to make the wisest decisions possible? Peter? And we maybe lost Peter Hwang there. Maybe I'll have you tackle that in the last two minutes that we have, Robert Shiller, because I think it's a big point. We don't want to have a whole bunch of people who just decide, you know what, the market burned us in year after year after year. I don't want to invest in a house or in the stock market. I need to just put my money under the mattress and not invest in the next big thing because I'm scared, I'm worried, I'm anxious.
Well, this is a problem. You can go either way. Some people are worried about being left out. They would feel I would be humiliated if I wasn't part of the big bull market, or they can be overly fearful. So what can we say? My general advice is I think that people need individual investing advice. They need to talk to some expert who is on their side. That's what you have to find. You have to find an investment advisor who is not trying to sell you stuff. Someone of good character. And the way you find an advisor is you ask friends who have contracted with advisors. And I think you also have to be ready to pay. That is, you want a fee-only advisor, possibly, who doesn't represent any interest. Of course, that person has to charge you an hourly fee for that service. Or you could go with a connected advisor. But as long as that person has a reputation as someone who's devoted to his or her clients.
We just have about 35 seconds left, Robert Shiller. But do you have just a quick piece of advice for young investors, people who maybe want to buy their own home, but we see young people not getting into the housing market in the same way, maybe being scared in this way about getting into the stock market? What's a piece of advice maybe for your students?
Young people are not getting into the housing market as much as formerly. As first-time buyers. They're living with their parents more. This is a phenomenon. Part of the reason, there was a recent New York Fed study, a good part of the reason is student debt. We've reached a situation in which people are borrowing a lot to go to college, and then after college they feel saddled with debt and they can't afford a house. On top of that, there seem also to be attitudes more toward renting, more toward central city urban living. This represents a taste change, I think is okay. I think it may be good for young people to rent for a number of years and get their careers established before they have to worry about maintaining a home.
And there are so many worries in this world that they're getting into. Robert Shiller is the author of Irrational Exuberance. It's in its revised and expanded third edition. Thank you so much, sir, for joining us. I appreciate the time.
My pleasure.
Our program produced by Josh Nalea. Thanks today to Lori Mack. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.